Welcome to Disruptive Successor, a show for next generation leaders in family businesses and entrepreneurs who want to disrupt the status quo and take their existing business to a whole new level. We all know that what got us here isn't going to get us there. This show will provide inspiration, advice, and resources to help you create massive impact.
This podcast is sponsored by myself, Jonathan Goldhill, and my company, The Goldhill Group, where we provide coaching for growing companies. I'm Jonathan Goldhill, and my purpose is simple: to guide entrepreneurial leaders in family businesses towards more freedom and fulfillment. I want entrepreneurs to get clarity around the changes that will make them and their businesses more successful so they can experience the same freedom I've enjoyed in my life. Our proven practices challenge business owners to think differently about their business and how they're running it, and quite literally become game changers in our clients' companies. Learn more at thegoldhillgroup.com website, where you can schedule your free strategy session. Hi, it's Jonathan Goldhill, and welcome back to another episode of the Disruptive Successor Show. Today, my guest is Bill Ekstrom. He is the CEO of Excel Institute, the world's first and only organization to measure and quantify leadership effectiveness. He and Sarah Wirth, his president, are considered the world's foremost authorities in metric-based performance coaching and growth. Their book, The Coaching Effect, helps leaders at all levels understand the necessity of challenging people out of their comfort zone to create high growth organizations. And Bill has a TEDx talk on the subject, which I'm going to ask Bill to introduce yourself and tell us a little about the TEDx talk. Welcome to the show, Bill.
Oh, thank you, Jonathan. And thank you for the opportunity. It's fun to be with you.
Yeah.
The TEDx talk was done actually, 4 years ago. It was in 2017 is when I actually was accepted to speak on the TEDx stage, and was in Reno, Nevada. And there's a whole story behind why Reno, Nevada. Guy who lives in Lincoln, Nebraska, going to Reno, Nevada. But
right,
yeah, that was fun. That was that was a life changing experience and a business changing experience for me. Mm.
And I gather that that talk was about getting people out of their comfort zone. Is that right?
Yeah, it was. But my kids have all often said that on my tombstone is going to read, nothing grows except in a state of discomfort. Mm. Our growth only occurs in a state of discomfort. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because the premise behind that talk is exactly that growth only occurs in a state of discomfort, but as humans, we are emotionally, psychologically, physiologically wired for comfort.
Yep.
And if growth only occurs in a state of discomfort, but yet we always seek predictability and comfort, then how do we continually grow? So it addresses that topic.
Yeah. Well, I know it's quite a challenge. As a coach myself, I'm oftentimes having to confront, am I in my comfort zone? And yeah, of course, I do reach for my comfort zone. And my job is to push people into states of discomfort and push them a little bit. So I know that if I'm not pushing myself out of my comfort zone, how can I dare ask my clients to push themselves? You find that?
Yeah,
true?
I know. Coaches need coaches too, right,
right,
Jonathan? I
mean, 100%.
That's why people hire people like you, is to see the world differently. And when you show them the world differently, it makes them uncomfortable.
Yeah,
but that's the only way growth occurs.
Yeah. So now your company seems to focus on leaders in the field of sports and in business. And I think we're aligned in thinking that leading is sort of synonymous with coaching. But let's talk about what's the difference between coaching, leading, and managing, because I know I have my definitions and distinctions, but I'd love to hear yours.
Well, I think the easy one to weed out of there is management or manager.
Yep.
It's very much an archaic term, Jonathan, that came about in our country in the industrial era. And it was all about consistent known inputs, creating consistent outcomes, and think no further than Ford's assembly line. Mm-hmm. It took into account very little to do with the human aspect of the equation.
Sure.
Which they really, by that, back then they weren't studying much about that. So that is really an antiquated term. And quite frankly, you know, I people who still use it are dating themselves. When it comes to leadership and coaching, to us, and when we studied athletic coaches, they seem to comprise a better understanding of what creates the most discretionary effort or growth outcomes of a team. Meaning that leaders, I can be a follower in a follower role, mm-hmm. and have good leadership,
yes.
traits, behaviors.
Yep.
But as a coach, you know, I have to have a team of people that reports to me, whether right. it's in the world of business or in the world of sport. And coaches know when it's appropriate and what is appropriate to manage. Great coaches typically, you know, to be a great coach, you're probably a great leader. It'd be hard to be a great coach without being a great leader. But great coaches know how to motivate. Great coaches know how to strategize. Great coaches have the proper structures and disciplines. Great coaches know how to identify talent, acquire talent, develop talent. They own everything that leads to a team outcome. Everything. And so when people say, well, you know, whether, again, in the world of sport or business, well, they're a great coach, they don't have great talent. My response is always the same. Well, who's in charge of the talent then? That's what coaches do. They own it all. So that's how I view coach. It just is, it's a more encompassing term, mm-hmm. than it is to be a leader. Now,
should leaders of in industry leading or industry dominating or best in breed companies, should the leaders call themselves coaches?
I think they should. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I really do. And think about this. Instead of, you know, take the frontline people that are new or they're just getting involved and they're moving into a leadership or what we call management role, right? Mm-hmm. I am moving into management. What if you call that a coaching role? What if I didn't get moved up into management? My upward mobility was into a coaching role. Mm-hmm. Now, how many people would want that? Would my pools dwindle? Would the attitude change? No, hold on. Management, I get to tell people what to do. But as a coach, I don't know if I don't know how that's going to work. So I think all the way up, it would be better understood and, quite frankly, better worked on if they were referred to as coaches.
So interesting. I think also that coaches bring a playbook. So I think of, you know, it's easy to look at sports coaches. I'm sure you have a lot of sports coach heroes where you are in the Midwest there, football heroes, especially coach heroes, but they come with a playbook. And so no matter what school or university or team they're coaching, they bring that playbook out, and that's the playbook that they run over and over. And I have found that as a coach that I am now bringing a playbook into my client companies, and I run that playbook over and over, and it works with great consistency. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's something that most leaders don't have, is they don't have a playbook.
You know, that's I like how you worded that. And I'll add one thing to that, Jonathan. Yes, they bring a playbook. They bring their method, right?
Mm-hmm. to
a team. Mm-hmm. But the great ones, that method's always evolving.
Absolutely.
It's always evolving. That playbook's getting new plays. It's getting yep. advanced. It's getting, you know, torn apart. Sections are going out. Other new sections are coming in. But they always have it. They yep. always have a method, that playbook that you described.
Yep. And it's unlike the IRS tax code. It doesn't just keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger. It, like you said, like you have to take sections out. You have to simplify it. You have to be able to communicate it, and people have to know the plays. it can't get too complicated. There can't be too many plays in the playbook. Otherwise, the followers will get confused as to what they're supposed to do.
Yes, not only too many plays, but you know, and you said it, it doesn't get thicker as much as it gets replaced.
Right. Exactly.
And so many times, you know, you talked about Midwestern athletic coaches having just finished the NCAA volleyball championships, where Nebraska ended up losing in the fifth set by 3 points to Wisconsin. And congratulations to Wisconsin. Nebraska's head coach, John Cook, is an amazing coach, but his playbook's always evolving. You know, and not just in the sense, of course, of plays in the disciplines and structures, but also in how he treats his athletes, his ability to connect with athletes, his need and understanding of the importance of creating trust relationships with athletes, with creating greater psychological safety. That's where the playbook's gotten bigger.
Right.
Not so much in how to execute a play, but it's how to execute my relationships with players is where I would say his playbook has grown the most.
I think that's very interesting. You know, as I'm reflecting back over my coaching career, and it goes back, I started coaching 2004, consulting in 87. So I've got 30 years experience, but there was a time when I was reading the biographies and autobiographies of people like Jack Welch, of course, business world leaders, who were exemplary in their field, but also
sports, coach Jack Welch, right?
Yeah. But then Gershner. The sports coaches also like Lou Holtz and I remember reading some books about his, you know, life and philosophy, and those also really helped me as a coach, which I think is interesting. I think that we all need role models and leaders and people who took their teams to great heights. And understand what their methodologies were a little bit.
Yeah, because some of the things that we see, you know, that are lead to the most growth in business apply to sports. And quite frankly, now we see in the classroom, in education.
I bet.
It's, you know, for example, what's interesting, because we have so much data, because we're a research-based company, the Excel Institute and Excel Sports, all based on research. So your chances of getting a great coach in the world of sport is 53%. Okay. What are your chances of getting a great coach in business?
33%?
54%.
Okay. Interesting.
Basically the same, statistically insignificant. And here's why. Because what creates, through the eyes of either student athletes or the eyes of a team in business, what creates this growth, what creates high performing teams, are the same qualities.
Gotcha. Makes sense.
And that's why it's, you know, across the board, to your point about studying athletic coaches as well as business coaches, because the same principles apply.
I think that's great. I'd love to share, if you have any other data points to share around coaching effectiveness, because the last study that I read dated back to, I think, 1980. It was like some Manchester study of the International Coach Federation coaches that were, you know, leaders in mid-market and larger corporations. And it certainly had some demonstrable research, but it seems really dated. And, you know, the world has changed a lot. What can you tell us about the effectiveness of coaching, how well it works, or maybe, you know, what are the best coaches doing differently than the others, and that sets them apart, you know?
Well, Jonathan, how much time do we have?
We got a good half hour. Go for it.
So, yeah, boy, where do I start there? In terms of data, I mean, we've measured probably over the last 5 years, over 200,000 interactions between leaders at work and the people on their respective teams. In the world of sport, we're probably now approaching on 100,000 of measurable interactions between athletic coaches and student athletes.
Wow.
So, yeah, we've got a lot of research on it. Great coaching doesn't matter. Yeah. I mean, the easiest place to quantify it in business is sales. Mm-hmm. Because sure. Everybody measures everything in a sales department.
Right.
And yeah, our last research in sales is that we could find the quantifiable differences is the great when we measured the coaches that were producing the most, that were doing the most, having the teams, led teams that grew the most to the highest levels longitudinally. And I'm going to pair because I can't remember the exact numbers, but they did 19% more of the, what we call these high growth coaching activities. Things like they did more one-to-one meetings. They had more effective, or they held more consistent team meetings. They had career discussions with the people on their teams. They gave consistent written documented feedback to the people on their teams. So they did, they did 13% more of those activities. Mm-hmm. They did them with 19% better quality. Okay. So in other words, not only did you and I, Jonathan, have a one-on-one meeting, mm-hmm. it was a quality one-on-one meeting through your eyes if you're on my team.
Which is basically, so if I understand what you're saying, is the more people do this kind of coaching, the more effective they are at it.
Right. So their teams on average produced $4.3 million more sales revenue than the bottom 80%. The top 20% produced, mm-hmm. who did these things, mm-hmm. produced on average $4.3 million more revenue than the bottom 80%. Not top 20, bottom 20. Top 20 to bottom 80.
Okay.
Not much of a difference.
The bottom 80 still did those activities or did not do those activities, you're saying?
Most of them do some of them.
Okay.
And the biggest correlator was the quality of it.
Okay. So, in other words, who was in the top 20? Let me understand. Was it the people that did more of it or
no, did so what we quality? Did is we met, we, good question. We measured the top 20% in terms of their growth.
Okay.
Who was growing the most? Okay. Gotcha. Who's producing the most? And then we went back and studied them compared to the bottom 80%. Mm-hmm. And we said, what are they doing differently mm-hmm. in terms of how they're leading, how they're coaching their people?
Right.
And you try and eliminate all the other outside influences. But what it boiled down to is they were doing more coaching and they were doing it in a better way.
Gotcha. Sounds like it was another chapter to add to the Good to Great book. Jim Collins' research, supporting
the value of coaching. All they have to do is go to our book.
Right, exactly. So how does a company measure coaching and leadership effectiveness? I mean, because in my business, I tell people, look, let's just get this right up front. This is sort of a brand promise. If I can't get you a 3-to-1 return on your coaching investment, then we probably shouldn't get started together. You're probably wasting your time. If I can get you a 3-to-1, then I know you'll have paid for my service. I know when I leave, it'll probably be instituted permanently. That's a good payback, you know. Or if we blow it and we don't get a 3-to-1, we only get a 1-to-1. Well, still, then you'll get, you know, the residual benefit. But it's really hard to measure if it's not, like, it's easy to measure sales growth or revenue growth or profitability growth. It's difficult to say, without spending a lot of money, that your leaders are that much better. Mm-hmm. Unless I did some kind of a, you know, pre-coaching leadership assessment and then post-coaching leadership assessment. Chances are with my clients, there would be a whole new set of leaders by the end of the engagement, and they weren't there in the beginning. Mm-hmm. So how does a company measure like coaching and leadership effectiveness?
Well, first of all, that's a really profound question. And Jonathan, the first question I would ask you, and I ask a lot of leaders, is do you think the performance of a team, whether it's in the world of business or sport, reflects how well that team is coached?
I would say yes.
Yeah. And everybody does. Not true. One out of 200 will say no.
Right. Okay.
For whatever reason, they're contrarian. Who knows?
Yes.
So yeah, most leaders say so. So what we tell people, then there's really only truly one way to measure how effective you are, and that's to go to the people on your team. Mm-hmm. And sometimes people pause and go, whoa, wait a minute. You mean it can be that simple? Yeah. I mean, if you want to measure customer service, do you go to your customer service reps or do you go to the customer to Absolutely. Measure how good your customers
are? Go to the customers. Yeah,
exactly. Right. Mm-hmm. So as a leader, I'm only as effective as how my team performs, and how they perform is based on who I am and what I do. So my actions, my behaviors, my words, right? Mm-hmm. And so we have to understand first what we're trying to accomplish. In this case, we're looking for what we call discretionary effort. How much more will a team produce? How much more will a team perform? How many more hours will they work? How much more engaged will they be? How much more effective will they be because of you, Jonathan, as my coach? Mm-hmm. Okay. Do I work that extra hour? Do I not take the call from the recruiter when it comes in because I'm committed to you and what we are doing as a team, right? Mm-hmm. So if we know that's the end objective, because all those things lead to growth, and let's face it, that's all anybody ever wants is mm-hmm. growth. I've never heard a business leader say, you know, we had a good year this year, so next year, no growth. We're good, right? Never heard that, have you, Jonathan?
No.
So if we know what creates growth, what we have to understand is what is a coach's impact on creating that growth. So that's where research comes in. And what we've been able to understand is there are six primary themes that leaders or coaches impact. And those are what we're measuring by surveying the people on these coaches' teams, respective teams.
What are some of those six things that we're talking about?
Oh, we measure, for example, their ability to create trust-based connections.
Right. Okay.
Psychological safety mm-hmm. is another theme that we measure. Structure that they have in place.
Right.
Their ability to develop the skills of the people on their teams. Their ability to communicate. And quite frankly, the last one is their ability to challenge in a healthy way. Mm-hmm. Because without challenging our people, growth does not occur. Mm-hmm. So those are the six themes that we measure.
Interesting. And so I guess, like, as I just reflect on what you said, so if I'm going into a client engagement and they have the luxury of wanting to measure the effectiveness of the coaching engagement, if I'm going after culture stuff, I might be, let's measure employee engagement or, you know, employee net promoter score. If we're trying to grow, then let's focus on revenues, net profit, gross margin improvement, there's measures like that. It's difficult to find organizations, I think, that are wanting to measure it and do the work. Do you find that's true? There's a resistance or reluctance?
Absolutely, there is, Jonathan. Yes. And so back up for a second, because you said some really interesting things. Mm-hmm. Engagement or those measuring revenue growth, whatever those things may be, those are all outcomes.
Right.
And I understand why people measure outcomes. My goodness, that's why you create P&Ls, right? And mm-hmm. and things like that. But what creates an outcome, an input? That's where we begin.
Right.
That's where measurement should begin, as to what is the input that creates an outcome. So if I can do an engagement work, say, hey, we're engaged, we're not engaged. You know, Gallup's engagement scores haven't gone up, down. They've just only gone sideways for the last 15 or 10 years, whatever the number is, because all we're looking at are outcomes.
Right.
It's the input that creates the outcome is where I think focus and attention needs to shift.
Okay.
And when I understand my behavior, what I do, I can change it. Now to your other point, it's hard to do because now you're focused on, now I have to accept, I have to own the fact that my behaviors, what I do and what I say with my team creates an outcome.
Right.
I can't blame. I can't point my finger at everybody on the team. I got to own it. And when I show people what, when our company shows people what they do, whether it's in business or sport, that's a hard thing for them to look at sometimes.
So you've taken psychological safety as one of the six measurements that are important as an input. Is that what I understand?
Yeah, it's psychological safety is an outcome, but what creates it or doesn't create it? Those are the inputs we're looking at.
Mm, okay.
So we're showing you the outcome, psychological safety, but in the measurements, we're showing what you do to create it or not create it.
Gotcha. All right, let's shift gears. Let's talk about discomfort, because that's an area that probably keeps people from hiring coaches. First, I think it's interesting, like, why doesn't everyone have a business coach? There was a point in time I stopped asking that question a long time ago and just realized there are people who are coachable and people who are not coachable and don't want to be coached, or they don't really need coaching. They have an internal drive or governor or something internally that they seem to be able to figure it out themselves.
Well, I'll even challenge that.
Okay.
Because you're right. There are people that do push themselves more than others. You just brought it up, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they push themselves in the way they want to be pushed.
Correct.
They don't allow someone like you to come into their life and say, we need to look at this or do this differently, you know, because they're right. Excuses. Well, I do it all myself. Look at me, look at my results, right?
Right.
And really what they're saying is, no, Jonathan, you're going to create too much discomfort.
Yeah. So do you think, is discomfort the thing that holds people back, you think, from choosing to get coached?
Oh, I'm trying to think of how I want to answer that so it doesn't sound flippant. So how was discomfort created? Let's take a step back for a second. Discomfort is created when outcomes are unknown.
Mm-hmm.
Comfort then is created when outcomes are predictable or known. If I reach out as a CEO and hire you, Jonathan, and say, I want you in my life, or let me rephrase, I'm thinking about hiring a coach, and I know you're going to come in and tell me things that I can change or should change to produce a different result. Right away, everything about that statement means it's unknown.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know you that well. I can get referrals, but still, I don't know you that well. I don't know what you're going to do. I don't know what you're going to say. I don't know what you're going to bring. All I know is that things will be different.
Yep.
And anytime I can't know what the outcome is, it creates discomfort. Now, different people, it creates varying levels of discomfort. But ultimately, my answer to your question, the long way around the barn, is yes. Not everybody doesn't have a Jonathan in their life because of the discomfort it creates by hiring a coach.
That is the area that I would call their blind spot. I mean, you're probably familiar with the coaching thing, whatever it's called, the Johari window, where it's the 2x2 matrix of, you know, what is known and what is unknown, what is public and what is private. The blind spot is like known to the coach, unknown to the coachee, but it's not private. It's like public, it's visible. And I think this is an area that a lot of people don't want to go into because they don't know what the outcome is going to be. Is that?
Yeah. I think, Jonathan, it's that simple.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's one of the concepts I tried to explain in the TED Talk. We're trying to explain in our book, The Coaching Effect,
mm-hmm.
is we talk about that. For a coach, For a CEO or an executive in business to all of a sudden understand that only 64% of the people on my team believe they have a trust-based connection with me, that's hard to take.
Not very good, right?
You know, to see that only 45% of my team feel psychologically safe, Wow. That can be hard to learn. Or even if it's 80%, right? That can be tough to see.
Right.
Yeah, that creates now those who do see it, those who are really growth minded, they want to know those numbers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So do you actually have a tool that the public can use to measure their team? Is it, how does someone get these kind of measurements from an organization like yourself?
Well, they work with our company. They contract either with Excel Institute or Excel Sports. That's, you know, that's where we work. Mm-hmm. You know, on what we have on our website on excelinstitute.com is really kind of fun. We do have a growth earnings assessment, which is free, mm-hmm. where you can go in and take a look at where you stand. Are you in a place of comfort, meaning that you're not growing as much? Are you in a complexity environment where you really are in a high growth mode, or are you in a state of chaos or stagnation where no growth is occurring, or perhaps negative growth is occurring? People can go to our site and take a look at that. That's a fun one. But organizationally, yes, we work, you know, with, like I said, businesses and athletic teams to help them understand that.
Yeah, I like that. Chaos, complexity, order, stagnation. It's kind of like the five levels of freedom that I used to teach my clients when you're first starting a business. It's chaos, right? Then you enter, let's say you get to $1 million in revenue. You're at that point where all of a sudden things are looking very different now. You start to need a manager or a management team from $1 to $10 million. There's a lot of complexity built in because you're starting to bump up against competitors and you're trying to get to, you know, pay off maybe all of your operating, the expenses, the capital expenses that you got into the business with, and you're trying to get to an operating profit that's a consistent basis. You're trying to get to order where you're putting processes and you've got good people in place. And now the question is do you go from order back into complexity into the next level of growth, or do you just hit sort of a ceiling and stagnate, which is a lot of what happens to a lot of companies. They get to that sort of $10 million level, I find, and they hit that stagnation. And so
that's a tough one to break through. Yeah.
Yes.
We call it the growth rings, and it's introduced in my TED talk, and we have a chapter of our book dedicated to that as well. But very good. You went through those well.
Yeah. Well, and then, you know, hopefully, like if you're looking to exit the business, then the stagnation period becomes where you basically prepare your business to harvest and sell. But sadly, too few businesses ever really make it to that point. You know, I think 2/3 of all businesses that get listed for sale never actually do sell. And so many of them are forced to just either half retire or stay in the business, or maybe they've got a family business member that can succeed them. And hopefully they've got an entrepreneurial drive to take them to the next level. But too oftentimes that next gen is got an entitlement mentality and they don't drive the business to the next level. They drive it back into the ground. So
yeah,
interesting.
That certainly can happen.
Yep, exactly. So, well, this has been interesting. Tell us a little bit about your book, The Coaching Effect.
Well, thank you for that opportunity, Jonathan. The coaching effect is exactly that. It is the effect coaches have on the performance and growth of business teams. Mm-hmm. And we, in the book, we outline what great coaches do in terms of activities, but we also outline how they do it well.
Gotcha.
And it's kind of a chapter by chapter understanding of not just what they do and how they do well, but also the impact. And we have all kinds of analogies and stories. We bring in examples from the world of athletics and business and everything. So even animals are mentioned in there. So it cuts across really anybody who's in a leadership or coaching role is applicable. And what's fun for us is one of the reasons we got in the world of sports is coaches and athletic directors were reaching out after we wrote the book, using our work and applying it in the world of sports. So
Gotcha. So there's a lot of takeaways in the book. Someone can read it and have actionable takeaways.
Someone can read it and quite literally start to change their actions and behaviors the next day.
So powerful. And that book is available, I take it, on Amazon?
Amazon, Barnes & Noble's, all the respectable outlets of books have a coaching effect, yes.
Fantastic. And if people want to learn more, can they go to excelinstitute.com, ecselinstitute.com?
Yeah, ecselinstitute.com. And I have a personal website, billextrom.com. Reach out to me. Reach out to our company. Yeah, questions. I love engaging and connecting with people. So I'm all over social media. My marketing people believe I should be out there more, but I do what I can.
Great. All right. Well, we'll have all that information in the show notes. Bill, thank you for sharing your wisdom, your knowledge, and your expertise as not only a student of coaching, but an expert, like a trainer of trainers in the coaching world. So thank you so much.
It's been an honor to be with you.
All right. So folks, if you enjoyed this, listen, subscribe, share it with others, and pick up a copy of The Coaching Effect with Bill Ekstrom. This podcast is sponsored by myself, Jonathan Goldhill, and my company, The Goldhill Group, where we provide coaching for growing companies. I'm Jonathan Goldhill, and my purpose is simple: to guide entrepreneurial leaders in family businesses towards more freedom and fulfillment. I want entrepreneurs to get clarity around the changes that will make them and their businesses more successful so they can experience the same freedom I've enjoyed in my life. Our proven practices challenge business owners to think differently about their business and how they're running it, and quite literally become game changers in our clients' companies. Learn more at the goldhillgroup.com website, where you can schedule your free strategy session.
Thank you for joining us on the Disruptive Successor Podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, please subscribe, review, and share with a friend who would benefit from the message. If you're interested in picking up a copy of my book, Disruptive Successor, go to disruptivesuccessor.com.